much. I don't think Demetrios has gotten as much academic exposure ever, two lectures in a row. And first of all, I would really like to thank Anna for inviting us to present our work here. We are really both delighted to have that chance. I thought we would be speaking in the Frankel room, which would have been particularly, although I've heard that it was not named after me, but after the great classicist Hermann Frankel, and unfortunately there's no family relation. So I will be speaking actually at the end, and then I will explain a little bit what originally motivated my interest in Themistius's paraphrase of metaphysics lambda. But for now I should stress that this project has been on the back burner of my research stove, so to speak, for a while, and so I'm really delighted that as brilliant a young scholar as you are has picked up this project and is doing really fantastic both philological and philosophical work on this text. So I will be letting him do the dirty work at first, and then I will add a few thoughts of my own at the end. So
okay, now there's no way I can top that introduction. So thanks, Carlos. I'm happy to see some of you from yesterday. Also, I won't be repeating myself too much, but just a bit. So Themistius's paraphrase of Aristotle's Metaphysics 12 received little attention from historians of ancient philosophy, despite it only being the only complete treatment of Book 12 that has come to us from antiquity. The main reason for this neglect is the fact that the work survives in its entirety only in medieval Hebrew translation. Than a Latin translation made from that. Furthermore, having no noticeable influence in late antiquity, but rather in medieval Arabic and Hebrew philosophy, where it was quite popular, the study of this work lies beyond the scope of most classically orientated scholars, as well as medievalists who don't read Hebrew. So I will be saying a few words on the history of the text and the problems it poses from a philological point of view. Now, if you look at your handouts, you can find at pages 7 and 8 a flowchart of the transmission of the text, somewhat simplified, as well as a table at page 8 with a distribution of the text per language. So you can see just exactly how much Arabic we have and where it, and to what part of to what chapters of Aristotle's Metaphysics 12 they are related to. Of course, the distribution between the length of the chapters isn't even, so it's like the picture you see is like only something close to what is really going on from the quantitative point of view. Okay, so if there's something unclear about that, maybe you can ask me later. Okay, so the original Greek is lost entirely. But the work was translated into Arabic, probably but not certainly, by the celebrated translator Ishaq ibn Hunayn from the second half of the 9th century. Yesterday I was much more confident because I think that's happened, because today we're more philologically oriented, so I'll be more careful in everything. Okay. So it was probably the translation of Ishaq ibn Hunayn, although the Arabic bio-bibliographical sources are not in agreement on this. Now, some of the Hebrew manuscripts state that the Arabic translation was revised by the famous scientist and philosopher Thabit ibn Qura from the end of the 9th century, and he was certainly qualified for that. But this too, I don't know how we can ascertain. Okay, so unfortunately, the Arabic translation in its entirety is lost, but some parts of it survive in various sources. So if you look at the distribution at the end, so the paraphrase of chapter 1 and the beginning of 2 survive, as well as most of chapter 4 and the beginning of 5. They survive in different places, not in the same manuscript. There are also shorter quotations from the work in some philosophical texts, most notably Averroes' long commentary on the Metaphysics, about which we talked yesterday, which also contains quite a few critical discussions of Themistius by Averroes. Now, the Latin translation of Averroes from the early half of the 13th century is the only source of knowledge the medieval Latins had of Themistius' approach to metaphysics lambda. Now, besides this, we possess an abridgment of the translation of chapters 6 to 9, done rather skillfully by an anonymous scholar who mostly shortened the text, but sometimes paraphrased it as well. So as you can imagine, it is very difficult to properly work with the text based on such partial and uneven remains. The Hebrew translation of the Arabic translation was done by Moshe ibn Tibbon of the famous Tibbon family of translators and philosophers in 1255. Luckily, we possess this translation in its entirety, and it was published in 1902 by Samuel Landauer as a part of the Commentaria in Aristotelium Graeca series. However, the existing edition is very problematic since it wasn't done on basis of an in-depth study of the surviving manuscripts, and the Arabic material Landauer had for control purposes was considerably less than we have today. Still, this is much better than Themistius' Decailo paraphrase, lost in both Greek and Arabic, and with a Hebrew translation which is barely readable. Okay, so there's worse. We can do worse. I am currently preparing a new critical edition of the Hebrew text, which takes into consideration all of the material that has come down to us in Hebrew and in Arabic. It is also worth noting that the Hebrew translation was in turn translated into Latin by the otherwise unknown Moshe Finzi in 1558. Needless to say, being so far removed from the original historically and linguistically, it is not very helpful in establishing the text. So this is more or less the philological state of play. Now, the challenges one encounters when trying to work with the Themistius' text are of two kinds. Some, which I would call circumstantial challenges, have to do with the history of the text and the nature and practice of medieval translations, more than they have to do with the content of Themistius' paraphrase. So since we have two different recensions of the Arabic, one based on the full translation and one based on abridgment, and we also have all sorts of fragments of different parts of the paraphrase all over the place, we cannot automatically assume that any Arabic fragment would be better than the surviving Hebrew just because it is less removed from the original. So this is true to all of the fragments scattered around in Arabic and Hebrew text, but you can see it especially concerning the abridged version, which sometimes paraphrases the text, and that can be noticed only through a careful comparison with the Hebrew. We have no case of an overlap between the original Arabic and the abridged Arabic, except for one case, which you can see in the handouts, where Averroes becomes more gray than the abridged version around it, we'll talk about somewhere in the middle of chapter 12, chapter 7 at book 12, this one over here. But the part where we have the overlap, unfortunately, are the specific part from the abridging that the abridger doesn't do any abridging. So he quotes the text exactly how it was. So we can't see any of the abridgment in practice. We don't have an Arabic whole and an Arabic abridgment together one by one. Okay, so in 1999, Rémi Brague, he published a French translation of the paraphrase. It was done pretty well, but there was one problem, and what he did was that he printed in bold the places where he relies on Arabic for a translation, and in regular font, lightweight font, the parts that relied on the Hebrew, and every time he had the chance to use the Arabic, he used the Arabic, and when he had no choice, he used the Hebrew. So in a way, all of the Arabic materials are treated as equal, and the text that we have, in a way, it's a translation of a text that doesn't exist. Okay, so it was okay. You know, you don't have any catastrophes there, but the approach to the text wasn't systematic enough. Okay, now an even more serious problem is that sometimes you find yourself in a real case of being lost in translation. And I'll give you one example, which I think will really show you the problem. Now, Aristotle, during his writings and the metaphysics, uses hule for matter and stoicheon for element. Right? We know that. Now, both terms are used in different levels of concreteness or abstraction in Aristotle's text. And in some places, they have rather ad hoc meanings, like in chapter 4 of book 12. So, hule can range from the abstract technical term of the underlying substratum of the substance to a more concrete immediate physical sense of a body. On the other hand, stoicheion can denote simply one of the four elements, like earth, air, fire, or water, or can have a more abstract sense as an underlying constituent. Now, from this terminological flexibility, it is not hard to imagine uses of stoicheion and hule, which have a very close meaning to each other. Now, in the Arabic translation, there is a tendency, at least in the first five chapters, to translate both hule and stoicheion into the same Arabic word, unsu. Okay, my Arabic pronunciation is horrible, I apologize. Unsu. So, in many cases, the Arabic blocks us from access to what term Themistius is actually talking about. Now, when you look at the Hebrew manuscripts, you can see that both the translator and some of the copyists feel that there's something wrong here. You can see that they're perplexed. And almost every manuscript, you have 10 manuscripts, almost everyone deals with it differently. So the distributions of the terms Chomer and Yesod, which Chomer is usually matter and Yesod is usually element, so the distribution of these two terms within the different manuscripts are different. Sometimes marginally different, sometimes very different. So you can see that they felt something here is wrong, and they had no way to solve this problem. Okay? So you can have anything between translating unsu all the time into matter, to translating it all the time into element, or to just take a guess in any given instance. Okay, with no common ground. So sometimes it's very heroic and I say convincing, like this is a good choice, and sometimes they were completely off the mark. And they could have, and it was like mere chance. So, to deal with a question like that is a lot of philological analysis. Okay, one of the main problems in Landauer's existing edition is that he didn't notice, or maybe he noticed, but he didn't note, that actually we can find two layers of the Hebrew, one which is a working draft, and another which is a more refined version of the translation. So when you have, so sometimes within the textual choices Landauer makes, you can find both the draft and the refined, like, lumped together. Okay, instead of choosing one of them this is what I work with, and then note the differences. Otherwise, so it occasionally gives you the wrong text, basically. Okay. So none of these are dramatic problems, but as tedious we are as philologists, we want to get everything right. So I say I'm complaining, but for the source material he had, it was very remarkable what he actually was able to achieve. Okay, so a different kind of difficulty has to do intimately with Themistius himself, and is rather strange methodology of paraphrasing. Now, unlike the more traditional commentary genre, like Alexander of Aphrodisias or Simplicius, which consists of a quotation of a passage from Aristotle's text followed by a commentary on it, Themistius' activity within the framework of a paraphrase poses much difficulty, since his text ceaselessly shifts between any of the following. He can do exact quotations from the Aristotle, he can reword his text, reorder the text, he can gloss, he can make a casual remark, he can make an extensive remark, and he can make a lengthy independent digressions which bear little resemblance to the text he's commenting about. So, more often than not, it is difficult to determine Themistius' own position toward the text he is paraphrasing. Sometimes he's simply presenting Aristotle's view, sometimes he adopts it, sometimes he interprets it in his own terms, sometimes he defends it, sometimes he offers tentative critical remarks, revises it, voices his own opinion with or without agreement with Aristotle. Any way you want. You have all of that here. So, in other words, it is fundamentally difficult to establish what Themistius' actually opinion is, and can sometimes result in contradictory elements within the paraphrase itself. Now, in the handouts, you'll find examples for different phenomena within the paraphrase, and the presentation discussion of some of them will enable us to talk about some of the themes within the paraphrase. So it would be very presumptuous of me to discuss all of these in length, because you have like these bombs of text, one of them after another. But I think it would be nice for you to have some English of these passages, because they were never available before. And they can give you some impression of different paraphrasing practices in Themistius. Now, having said that, I will take some time to elaborate on one point which I find particularly interesting, And that's what I take to be Themistius' superimposing of a cosmogony in Aristotle's text. I talked a little about that yesterday. I hope that they can raise some debate during the discussion. Okay, so when you look at text one, okay, I'm not going to discuss it at all. You just can see that Themistius is practically repeating Aristotle's text. So you can see this here and there during the course of the paraphrase, especially when we get to astronomy. Okay, like me, Themistius is a very lazy astronomer, and if he has astronomical text, he just repeats it, he wants to get through it. He has nothing to add to it, just, okay, this is the part, I'm just like quoting it and going on. Okay, so this is what you have in text one. Now, in text two, you can see a little addition to Aristotle's text, which explains what is meant by the denial of coming to be from form and matter. Now, this is an example of a problem because taken by itself, there's no way to know whether this clarification is Themistius' own or simply a gloss by the translator. Things like that happen. And that would make all the difference in the world in this specific issue, and I'll come back to this short clause later. Now, in text 3, you can find a case where Themistius makes a very small change to Aristotle's argument that is rather puzzling. I don't really understand why he does it. If you look at Aristotle's text, you can see that he mentions the sun and its oblique course, or the ecliptic, together. And if you look at Themistius' text, you can see that he says that the sun is a remote cause. Well, the ecliptic is an even remoter cause than the sun. I don't know if this makes sense, but as I said, I'm a very bad astronomist. But this would just show you how Themistius makes a little change in the argument that reflects some kind of different understanding of the text. Now, in other places within the paraphrase, especially the one we discussed yesterday, the sun and the ecliptic are mentioned together as a joint cause. So we have an inconsistency here within Themistius himself. So now we'll just go into the more substantial stuff. In text 4, we're talking about the conclusion of Metaphysics 12.3, where Aristotle offers a condensed argument that supposedly rejects the needs for Platonic ideas in coming to be, as he already believes that there are sufficient principles to explain coming to be without them. Now, as you can see, Themistius replaces this brief outline with a much more detailed argument, which is based on Aristotle's elaborate discussions in Metaphysics Data 7-9. So Themistius restates Aristotle's argument because he wants to offer a response to it, and the response immediately follows in the text, and that's what we talked about yesterday. So this is the place where he discusses spontaneous generation, perhaps the most studied part in the paraphrase. Okay, so for the defense he offers to make sense, Themistius replaced Aristotle's laconic remarks with a much more elaborate argument. So this is perhaps paraphrasing in a wider sense. Themistius feels he has something important to say about the topic Aristotle is writing about, so he thickens Aristotle's comments to make them a better launching pad for voicing his own opinion. Okay, so the next text is a theme I would like to take some time with, since I think it has rather interesting implications. This is where I go into dangerous territory. Now, if you look at it, you will see that Themistius will completely change Aristotle's argument, not just restate it or thicken it, in order to promote his own philosophical agenda. Now, the context of this discussion is Aristotle's distinction between potentiality and actuality as modes of non-existence and existence in Metaphysics 12, chapter 2. And this would pave the way for a discussion of matter and form. Aristotle links his argumentation to views held by pre-Socratic philosophers and offers an explanation of Anaxagoras' principle, all things were together, before refining it. So I quote first Aristotle, "It is not satisfactory to say that all things were together, simpliciter, for they differ in their matter, since otherwise, why did an infinity of things come to be and not one thing? For Anaxagoras' nous is one, so that if matter also is one, that must have come to be in actuality what the matter was in potentiality." So Themistius takes Aristotle's claim and gradually transforms it into something completely different. And I'm quoting from the other side of T5. So, and if the body from which things, again, I apologize for the rather clunky translation. And if the body from which things that come to be, was one in itself in all of its states, and did not have fundamentally in its nature an alternating logos, we talked about it yesterday, it would have been impossible for a plurality, which we can see has already been created, to be created from it. For if a thing is truly one, it is impossible for it to receive a plurality. It has to have a fundamental potency that will make it possible for it to be one and to receive a plurality. And as for that which does not receive a potency for plurality, it will be incorrect to say about the creator that he devised it in that way and afterwards coerced it to be susceptible to plurality, for that is not fitting of the wise. Now, where is the mysticism? Where is Aristotle? We're just on a completely different place now. Okay, so the argumentation here is in line with Aristotle's claim that the plurality of different objects in the world undermines the assumption that all is one with regard to matter if it is taken without qualification. But here, Themistius departs from Aristotle toward a new argument which is based on the wisdom of the creator. Themistius sees two possible alternatives regarding the relation between matter's oneness and susceptibility to plurality. Either matter was at first completely one, without any potency for plurality, and then the creator changed it as to enable it to receive plurality. That's option one. Or matter had a potency for plurality from the get-go. The first option is rejected through an appeal to the wisdom of the creator. It doesn't seem particularly wise to determine the nature of a thing in a certain way, only to alter its nature substantially as soon as it is about to fulfill its function. This would mean that the original nature of the object was inappropriate. Now, the creator is wise, hence matter always had potency to receive plurality. In other words, the question about how to understand matter's oneness conditioned upon the correct interpretation of divine wisdom. This view isn't compatible with Aristotle, who nowhere in the text refers to God as a creator, nor does he appeal to God's wisdom as a justification for the nature of matter. But Themistius goes on, and I quote again, Anaxagoras thinks that the creator is one, and that he is wise. But when he was asked, where does the plurality in things that come to be from, given that the creator is one and the body from which coming to be proceeds is not susceptible to plurality, he replied, and there is no parallel to this in any other testimony of Anaxagoras as far as I can tell, and I asked the Brown about this. So he says, the thought of the creator, just like a mason, a carpenter, or a craftsman, he takes one of the bodies, separates it off in the manner he needs to, and connects it, conjoins it, and compounds it in different forms according to what he needs. These are like I don't remember the Greek, but these are the standard, probably a translation of the standard terminology Anaxagoras uses for the work of Nous on matter. Okay, so Themistius explains that the fact that matter is one at first and then turns into a plurality does not, for Anaxagoras, undermine the wisdom of the creator, which is expressed in a different way through the analogy of the craftsman. Anaxagoras says that the creator, like a craftsman, makes one body by disassembling another and rearranging its part according to a plan. Now, Themistius seems to be saying that for Anaxagoras, the only principle of plurality is the creator's thought. Matter is not susceptible to plurality by nature, but is rather coerced by the creator's action upon it. And Themistius is unconvinced by this, and he says, we do not find this issue to be as Anaxagoras said, for we find that the body had already completely changed, first into the four elements, and then into the plants and animals. The plurality of things that come into be comes from two things, namely from the creator, in the plurality of forms he gave the body, and the body, for the body has been positioned as the receptor. Okay, now just a short remark, sometimes, I think probably for pedagogical reasons, Themistius uses body instead of matter, okay? And I don't know why, but he does it all the time until a certain point of the paraphrase. So I continue the quotation. This is like, for example, a person who takes a piece of wax and makes from it many forms of animals, plants, and soulless things. For the plurality in these forms come from two things. One of them is the craftsman who crafts them, and the other is the wax that his craft works upon. The craftsman, because he crafts many forms, and the wax, because it is possible for it to receive many forms. So, for Themistius, observation of the world is enough to realize that matter is susceptible of plurality, for there is an actual plurality of things of different nature. Matter, or the body, had already undergone the changes into the plurality of natural things, and they can change it to each other. So, Themistius does not deny Anaxagoras' view for Aristotle's sake, but for the sake of a third view he wants to advance. Aristotle and Anaxagoras, as Themistius understands them, each posit one principle of plurality. Aristotle's principle is matter, and this is insufficient for Themistius, who also seeks a principle for the plurality of forms, which he finds in the notion of a divine creator lifted from Anaxagoras' view. But Anaxagoras sees only the thought of the divine creator and not matter as a principle of plurality. So, having rejected this view as well, Themistius proceeds to synthesize Anaxagoras and Aristotle and declare that there are in fact two principles of plurality, matter, or the body, which by nature can become anything, and the creator, who actualizes matter by giving it a plurality of forms. The important common feature which places Themistius in the same camp as Anaxagoras and apparently opposite Aristotle is that both of their accounts assume a divine creator. In short, Themistius utilizes Aristotle's discussion of Anaxagoras as a means to introduce a cosmogonic dimension which is absent from Aristotle's original discussion, and then retain this dimension despite the rejection of Anaxagoras' view. So, for Themistius, the question of the plurality of matter and form is ultimately a part of a cosmogony, and the world we live in is a product of this cosmogony, which has already been completed. The natural process of coming to be and perishing, Aristotle's world, was preceded, in a way, by divine artistry. So this mini cosmogony Themistius provides us adds up to the following sketch, if I understand it correctly. The divine craftsman determines matter as a oneness, which has a potential plurality. What's more, he himself is also a principle of plurality owing to the plurality of forms according to which he molds matter into plurality of things. He gave the body. Not all natural things are molded directly from the original matter. The process has several stages, starting with the elements and gradually moving up to complex substances like animals and human beings. This process has already been completed. Coming to be as we experience it happens in a world that had already undergone this process, one of which the natural order of things has already been established. So, in this sense, Aristotle's account of coming to be can be placed in the final stage, the one in which we live now. The unconscious physical process of coming to be in nature is an effect of a previous divine artistry. So, in other words, Themistius superposes on Aristotle's physics a cosmogony of design. Now, if you allow me to speculate a bit further, if that wasn't bad enough, okay, let's return to T2. Now, which was like this short sentence. Okay, so Metaphysics 12, chapter 3 opens with Aristotle's declaration that neither the matter nor the form comes to be. Now, if the addition I think in the text is actually really Themistius' addition, so in line with the previous discussion, he adds an important qualification. It is impossible for the form or its recipient to come to be, i.e., to be created by means of coming into be. Okay? So this short gloss on Aristotle's text gives the impression that Themistius is doing more than merely denying coming to be from matter and form, and that he has something to say about their own ontological origin. This is a question not raised by Aristotle, who believes that the forms of natural kinds are everlasting. So, then Themistius continues, and he says that whoever says that each of the two comes to be as such, this is not in your hands, I'm sorry. So, whoever says that each of the two comes to be as such, his saying can be extended ad infinitum. For if the receiving body is created by way of coming to be, again, you see, created by way of coming to be. And this is for another part of the text. It is evident that its coming to be is from another receiving body, and it will perish when the other body perishes. This is a restatement of Aristotle's argument for why for matter and form don't come to be, taken from the physics mostly. So, when the Themistius denies that matter is created by way of coming to be, does he imply that matter is created another way? Or rather, like Aristotle, that it is everlasting? The discussion so far, along with Themistius' phrasing, seems to suggest that the denial of coming to be of matter and form does not deny that it has an ontological cause beyond the realm of coming to be. Now, the assumption that matter and form are created, that is, start to exist without undergoing a process of coming to be, is more in tune with the cosmogony Themistius has already advanced. Okay, so this is like support for what I maybe irresponsibly said earlier. Okay, so on a side note, I think it's worth mentioning that in medieval Arabic philosophy, most notably in Avicenna's physics, we can find a distinction between coming to be and a temporal creation. And Avicenna holds a view very similar to Themistius's when he writes that prime matter does not come to be, but is rather a temporally created. This is very close, and the argumentation is also very close. So, obviously, defending this cosmogony thesis in Themistius requires much more work, but I think you can at least see through my discussion just how flexible Themistius's mode of paraphrasing is, and that he is sometimes approaching Aristotle's text with a very specific agenda. And this takes us to the last feature I'll be talking about, after which I'll turn the discussion over to Carlos. So, the last thing I would like to talk about, it's what maybe can be labeled as the politicization of the cosmos. One of the features Carlos will talk about is Themistius' transformation of Aristotle's God into something that is much more than Aristotle's own first unmoved mover. Now, one of the things Themistius does in this context is to take every chance he can get to describe the cosmos and God as its highest principle, using a political metaphor. And you can see this in T6. He sometimes just goes on and on about this. Now, this feature opens up a possibility to perhaps study aspects of Themistius' paraphrase alongside the political discussions in his orations, where the emperor, analogically to God, is described as the living law. And I think it also gives us the opportunity to explore the paraphrase's function as a bridge not only between Greek and Arabic metaphysics and theology, but also political philosophy. The most notable candidate would be Al-Farabi, the great Arabic philosopher from 870 to 950, who read Themistius' paraphrase and is perhaps the greatest political philosophers in medieval times. So, before I finally give Carlos a chance to speak, I would like to offer a general observation. Now, although we didn't dig deeply into the text, I think you can already notice that Themistius is taking a lot of liberties with it. I would like to suggest that Themistius' paraphrase should not be taken strictly as an interpretation of Aristotle's Metaphysics 12, nor should it be seen as a product of confrontation with it. Themistius, I believe, makes Aristotle's text work for him, not the other way around. In other words, Themistius approaches the text with an already established worldview and explores how Aristotle's metaphysics can be utilized to advance it. I'm not sure this would hold for the other paraphrases of Themistius. I'm talking just about the Metaphysics 12. Okay, so we can talk about that more during the discussion, and thank you very much. And Carlos will now talk about the more exciting God stuff.
Yeah, I don't know if it's going to be more exciting, but I hope it will add a few additional aspects. So you obviously already pointed out a number of distinctive doctrines in Themistius' paraphrase, and I will be focusing on one additional distinctive doctrine. But before that, I wanted to tell you a little bit about how my interest actually in Themistius' text came about. So I first got interested in Themistius' paraphrase when many years ago I was trying to figure out how the philosophical concept of the unity of nature emerge. And according to one prominent scholarly narrative, this is above all the achievement of Spinoza's substance monism, so Spinoza's claim that only one substance exists, namely Deus sive natura. And according to this narrative, Spinoza established the principle of unity of nature by arguing that the same stuff plays by the same rules always and everywhere. Now this move supposedly had tremendous implications for science and religion. Spinoza freed philosophy, according to this narrative, freed philosophy and science from its medieval fixation on the transcendent and incorporeal God. He established the metaphysical framework in which modern science, unencumbered by theology, could turn to the systematic investigation of nature. Now, this scholarly narrative always bothered me, since pretty much all medieval Muslim and Jewish philosophers that I had studied argued that the natural order in some way inheres in God, conceived as reason, conceived as intellect. As the 14th century Jewish scholar Prophet Duran puts it succinctly, and this is text number 7 on the handout. So that's, I think, a very succinct statement of the doctrine that I have in mind. So he says, all the existence, kol ha-nimtza'im in Hebrew, are inscribed in God's essence, blessed be He, and His essence, exalted be He, is one form which comprises all existence. Now, that's not Spinoza, but you can get to Spinoza from there, and it clearly is a quasi-monistic ontology, quasi, I say, because for the medieval philosophers, matter is excluded from God, whereas, as you know, for Spinoza, extension is one of God's attributes. So there's a clear difference between the medieval position and Spinoza's position, but I don't think one can say that Spinoza somehow affected intellectual revolution. Now, as Shlomo Pinis has shown in a seminal article on Themistius's paraphrase that was published in the late 1980s, the source of the view that the natural order inheres in God is Themistius's paraphrase of Metaphysics 12. So that's how I first got interested in this text. So that's a little bit of, I guess, biographical scholarly background. Now, it is thanks to the interest of medieval Muslim and Jewish philosophers in Themistius that the paraphrase has been preserved at all, right? So we have spoke about the fragmentary state of this preservation, but it's thanks to the interest of these philosophers that we have the text at all. Now, let me briefly make a proposal to explain this interest. Why were medieval philosophers interested in Themistius? And part, of course, the interest of medieval philosophers in Themistius is related to the interest in the Aristotelian tradition in general. They considered Aristotle the pinnacle of philosophy and Themistius one of his important Greek commentators. But I think that there's also a more specific reason for the interest in the paraphrase of Metaphysics 12 in particular. Medieval philosophers saw themselves as philosophers, but for the most part, they were also committed to their religious tradition, Judaism, Islam. So they felt the need to resolve tensions between the God of philosophy and the God of religion. Now, one stinging charge against philosophy was made by the Muslim, by the great Muslim theologian Al-Ghazali in the 10th, early 11th century, and then repeated by the Jewish poet and intellectual Judah Halevi, that the God of the philosophers does not know particulars and hence cannot interact with individual human beings. Now, in light of criticisms such as this one, which later medieval philosophers took very seriously, in light of criticisms such as this one, the God of Aristotle, who according to Metaphysics 12:9 knows only himself, must seem particularly unsuited for performing the role of the God of the Bible or the Quran. This difficulty, I suggest, in part accounts for the interest of medieval philosophers in the paraphrase of Metaphysics 12, in which Themistius shows, ostensibly on the basis of Aristotelian premises, that God's knowledge of his effects, or to use religious language, of his creatures, can be derived from his knowledge of himself. Right, so this is a key move in the paraphrase. So medieval philosophers, unlike me, weren't primarily interested in Themistius's quasi-monistic ontology, but in his concept of divine knowledge. In fact, they rarely spelled out the monistic implications of this concept of divine knowledge, which followed from Aristotle's claim that in the act of cognition, subject and object of cognition are the same, are identical. So if God knows his effects, he must in some way be identical with them. Now, obviously, this was not the only thing that interested them in the paraphrase. And, you know, we saw yesterday Averroes' critical engagement with Themistius's doctrine of spontaneous generation. But I think this was a key doctrine that attracted medieval philosophers to Themistius's paraphrase. I think they found there a solution to a certain tension between their philosophical and religious commitments and a way of answering charges such as the one brought forth by Al-Ghazali and Judah Halevi, that the God of the philosophers does not know particulars. Now, interestingly, Themistius doesn't offer us a full argument for attributing knowledge of things other than God or other than nous to nous. He does, however, try to address the worries of that Aristotle raises about attributing such knowledge to nous, to the divine intellect, to divine reason. And this made Themistius into a valuable resource to medieval philosophers who were, of course, aware of Aristotle's worries. So they found in Themistius a resource to address these worries. that come from attributing knowledge to God of things other than God himself. Now let me very briefly and roughly summarize what I think Aristotle's main worries are as he sketches them in Metaphysics 12:9. And as you know, this is a very compact and terse text, so I have no ambition to really unpack this here, but I just want to point to what I think the main worries are that Timisius is aware of. So they're related to two features of nous, that it is the best thing and that it is unmoved. But on account of these two features, Aristotle thinks, in my understanding, that he can rule out that nous knows anything other than itself. For one thing, Aristotle argues that the excellence of nous is determined by the object and not by the act of cognition, since, I quote, the act of cognition will also belong to that which cognizes the worst. So if nous is the best thing, its only suitable object of cognition must be nous itself. Moreover, if nous were to cognize something other than itself, this would entail a change to the worse and hence some form of motion, but nous is unmoved, so such motion must be ruled out. So Aristotle concludes that nous, I quote, cognizes itself, and I think he means only itself, since it is what is most excellent in this cognition is cognition of cognition. Finally, nous's object of cognition must also be internally one, according to Aristotle, since if it were composite, this would entail change to nous, I quote, while going through the parts of the whole. And hence, we would again have some form of motion, which, as we saw earlier, is ruled out because nous must be unmoved. Let us now examine a key passage in Timisius' paraphrase in which Timisius clearly departs from Aristotle while at the same time trying to address these worries that Aristotle raises in Metaphysics 12:9. And this is text number eight on the handout. So Timisius is right. First, it, so nous, the divine intellect, cognizes itself, then something else. Awal maya kunduhu zatuhi thumma shai ache, then something else. It cognizes the intelligibles that are existent in it, not in the way of passing from one to the other. It cognizes all things suddenly at one and the same time. For it cognizes all existing things as they are, and as they were made to exist by it as they are. It cognizes all the existence not as being extraneous to its nature, kharija an tabiatihi, or as acts alien to it, but it is it that generates them and creates them, and they are it. Wa'alati here, and they are it. For God is the nomos, namus, and the cause of the order and the arrangement of the existent things. He is a living nomos, such as the nomos would be if it were animate, saw itself, and cognized itself. So clearly for Timisius, nous cognizes not only itself, but also something else, shayache, something else. In fact, cognizes all existent things. But this is compatible with nous being the best thing, since all existent things inhere in nous's nature and are not extraneous to it. So the primary object of cognition remains nous itself, only that for Timisius this also entails the cognition of all things caused by nous. So the secondary object of cognition does not entail a change to the worse and hence does also not entail motion for Timisius. Right? So in a certain sense, nous still only cognizes itself, but that entails that it also cognizes that which follows from it. And since nous, according to Timisius, cognizes all things suddenly at one and the same time, there's also no change in motion caused by going through the parts of the whole. Now, Timisius doesn't provide a full argument for his striking claim that nous both knows and is all existent things. So let me try to very briefly offer a somewhat speculative reconstruction of what I think the argument is, based in part on how medieval philosophers interpreted Timisius' move here. And so this is also on your handout, attached to text 8 on the last, on page 6. So I think the first premise of the argument is nous is the first cause of the form of all existence. So when Timisius says that nous knows all existence, I think he means the form of all existence. That nous knows and is all existence, I think he means the form of all existence. The second premise is nous cognizes itself. And then the first conclusion is nous cognizes the first cause of the form of all existence. The third premise is the cognition of the cause entails the cognition of the effect, which is something that Mencius actually does not clearly spell out in that text, but I think one has to introduce that premise. The second conclusion is nous cognizes the form of all existence, of which it is the cause. And then the fourth premise is in nous, the subject of cognition and the object of cognition are the same, are identical. And then the third and final conclusion is nous and the form of all existence cognized by it are the same, are identical. So that's where you get what I called earlier quasi-monistic ontology. Now, let me finally propose very briefly and speculatively four possible reasons for why Themistius adopted this concept of divine knowledge, which on the face of it clearly departs from Aristotle's position in Metaphysics 12.9, and much more would need to be said about this, but unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, we don't really have time. So so this is something that I will have to work out in the future. But I thought that I would nonetheless share with you some ideas that I have about that, and that we may or may not pick up in the discussion. So four possible reasons. One reason may be genuinely philosophical, right? Themistius concluded that nous's self-knowledge entails knowledge of the effects caused by it, and so he spelled that out. Secondly, Themistius's move may be part of a broader project of trying to harmonize Plato and Aristotle, and we talked about the possibility of that project in Themistius yesterday. It's not clear that he really has this project, but it's certainly possible and sometimes looks at this way. The Platonic position from Alcinous onward seems to have been that Plato's forms are the thoughts of nous. Now, this harmonization project, in turn, may have been motivated by the desire to offer a unified pagan philosophical position in debates with Christian theologians, right? So Themistius, of course, is a pagan philosopher at a Christian, mostly Christian court, if one disregards Julian the Apostate for a moment, right? It's possible assume that he was, to some extent, engaged in debates with Christian theologians. Thirdly, Themistius may be responding to charges of Christian theologians that the God of the philosophers, unlike the God, the Christian God, knows nothing about his creatures and doesn't care about them. Although the paraphrase doesn't make explicit reference to debates with Christians, some passages can be interpreted as reflecting such debates. And we saw that in your Arx presentation that, for example, Themistius uses this language of creation. So there are a number of, indications that one can interpret as reflecting the possibility of Themistius' awareness of the position of Christian theologians. And fourthly, and lastly, Themistius may have wanted to provide a metaphysical model for his concept of the political ruler as a living law. Right, and this is something that you have mentioned also at the very end of his presentation. Now, this list is not meant to be exhaustive, and none of the reasons I mention is exclusive. In other words, it is quite possible that several or all reasons account for Themistius' departure from Aristotle on this question of what the content of divine knowledge is. And that's basically all that I had to add, so thank you very much.